Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting here with Ben Hunter, and we're delighted to be able to have a chat with Tim Rogers about his new book, Detours. New book, I say. Only book, Detours. Welcome, Tim.
Only book so far.
Only book so far, Detours.
We wish you many more.
Well, yeah, it's... I think now that I've gotten over the shock, because as I mentioned before, when the package came and there were copies there, my postal delivery gentleman gave me this very knowing wink and said, best of luck, Tim. And I took the box and put it underneath my bed and tried to forget that it was there. But now that I've gotten over the shock that it's actually in print, I can start looking for something outward of myself that I can try and just see if I've got any... talent for writing, I guess. That was the exercise.
Ben and I have read your book.
And so, it's good.
Yeah, so we can tell you that it's a good book. So we're booksellers. We like to sell books and we like to talk about books being better than they are, but we'll push aside the curtain for you here and just reveal that we actually liked it. As two readers who just stumble across this book and the number of books we get given.
Because we're booksellers, we do like to... What were your words again?
Sorry. I'm never going to read them again. This isn't recorded, is it?
talk about them as being far better than they actually are.
We're always optimistic about books. Always. So we approach books optimistically, and it's lovely to actually be rewarded with a good book.
I couldn't agree with you more. I've only I did study literature as a kid, and sort of did rather well. But I only feel that I've stepped into being able to be a reader in the last 10 years, because I don't think I read a novel. I read Crime and Punishment and Crime and Punishment again. In 20 years, I just didn't read, and I was wondering why I was getting so sad and lost and anxious, and discovering stepping into either literature and non-fiction, into memoir, and suddenly you find a peace and an interest in the world. And so when I was asked again to step into writing, I thought, well, this is a noble form that I want to try and rise to. Because it's done so much for my own health, and I'd like to spread the word however possible.
It does actually show the reading. It comes through. The use of language in it is rich, which is wonderful, because we do get a lot of memoirs and biographies that are very bare in the writing style, because people are concentrating on the getting to the truth,
facts.
Or the facts, or
the
that
facts.
Sort of thing.
The names.
And the words are second, yet you seem to enjoy rich language, and it comes through in your book.
I find it very big. It's a humorous and it's a way of expressing joy, I think, to use language like that. But again, checking yourself that I wasn't running to the dictionary every page. It happened a lot. I was surprised in an almost aleatoric way where words would come into phrases and sentences like a ghost knocking at the door, and I would have to go and double check. And more often than not, it would be the perfect word. And I thought, well, I don't use that word in everyday language, but by hell now I'm going to. And why it had been there in if not in my vernacular, then in my imagination. And then getting to use it, having all these really wonderful experiences that happen in songwriting as well, because often you'll find musical phrases that if you're not musically trained, which I'm definitely not, and you wonder, how did I go from this chord to there, and how that melody, and it's, again, there just must be some storage of information through listening and through reading in there, and they can be extracted.
Well, you do have... publishing a book, handing a book to someone like a publisher, an editor, those people, they will tell you when you're not using the word right, and they are brutal. George Orwell's Purple Passages, where you go, this is the best passage in the whole book, look how wonderfully I wrote it, and they just put a red line through it and go, that's out.
The red line.
Yeah.
Gee, the experience of being edited was new. I hadn't been edited in... It had been suggested I need an editor in songwriting,
Is that from the crowd, someone yelling out, or?
Generally not. I just hear, you can't sing. But the once an AR guy in, for Warner Brothers in America suggested I just take out every second word from my lyrics because there are far too many lyrics in there. And I just thought, I took him, we were at Musa and Frank's in Los Angeles, and I just thought, every second word. But I thought, is this some kind of Brian Eno method? It doesn't matter if the sentence isn't going to flow. Just take out every second word, when really he meant write less.
Yeah.
And working with my agent, who was my editor as well, Melanie Ostell, for the most part, and write long, Tim, write long. And then you'd get this just swathes of red line and red pen through there. And of course, I'd say, well, you wanted me to write long. And I guess you write long to be reduced.
Yeah, well, they can't work if you haven't got a big pile of clay. They can't cut anything away from it, can they?
Well, I can try. I think the collaborative aspect of writing, I didn't expect at all. I knew that there would be, it'd be a part of it, but that I've really enjoyed the how much of a collaboration it was. And for some reason, I don't exactly know why yet, I'm unable to enunciate. I think it was important that I wrote with women. Who are about my age. I don't know why it was important, but it feels important. Both Melanie Ostell and Catherine Milne at HarperCollins encouraged me to write about love and about romantic love, and I found it very difficult to. Though it didn't really even occur to me, and I thought more about that, and then I wrote a couple of fictional pieces that were so indebted to, in particular, Barry Hannah, because I thought, wow, how can I write about this in a honest way? And I'd rather fictionalise it, and it just didn't work. So,
is that the chapter where you introduced the hurricane? Is that the tough one?
Yeah. The original version of it was. I guess it was just trying too hard. I wanted to write something fictional, and because I didn't quite understand, I didn't know how to explain the relationship other than, I mean, what is the heck, writing about love is...
Especially as a participant, it's really difficult.
I aim in romance to be a participant.
Always.
Most times. and to write about it in a way that's interesting to anyone else. And I, being a... in a rock band for 30 years, I consider that I have to be a romantic. And then with romantic love, I'm not very realistic about it either. I'm an enthusiast, enthusiastic participant. And then, of course, it's an actual person who I love dearly, and so I didn't want to betray that.
Is she seeing the manuscript as it's being written?
No. I mean, I consider the Hurricane my partner as a participant and a contributor, because we live a very a private life together, and a lot of our talk is about literature or about poetry or about art. But no, I didn't show her, and then I took the honourable way of talking to her about it, and that I got royally drunk, and I read it to her very nervously, and it was all okay.
It's weird to me that when I...
It was terrifying.
It's brilliant. That whole bit is brilliant. It was the way in which you creep up to it as well, you know, sitting in the bar, and you slowly explore it, and then the way in which you bring her into it. I just found it brilliant. I just thought it was absolutely marvellous. And the time in both your lives, all that sort of stuff, honest, raw, even the way you describe how you actually manage, or not manage, the relationship.
We barely manage the relationship.
Yeah, leaves the door open, leaves things alive. It felt alive, that whole thing, and a very must have been, I mean, we just described how difficult it has been.
How difficult it is tempered a little, because I've been writing songs for 30 years, and I only write about things that are very dear to me, and So that going ahead and just writing something and feeling, yes, this is art, this is fine, or just feeling that you don't even consider it art because you're just doing it and it's so natural to you and this is what you love and I write music, and then writing this book, I've sort of lost the drift with a gin on one in one hand and one hand on the quill and ink. because that's the way I still write it, of course. And not thinking about it until the record's there or the book's there, and then that's when you go into panic, particularly about my daughter. I flew to New York to be with her a little while ago, and I had to sit her down and say, hey, you know, you'll probably never read it, but I hope she doesn't. But I said, darling, I do write about us, and I had to explain some things to her about my life, and she just put a hand on mine and said, Dad, I do know you, you know. And then we went out for burritos, and that was it. She just really gave me this very, very knowing look and said, well, Dad, I know you. I know this. I probably know more about you than you think I know.
Terrifying.
Absolutely terrifying. But then wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, I don't need to lie too much to her.
I was reading the book, and one of the things that really struck me was the title, Detours.
Can I tell you the original title?
Yeah.
Maintaining My Druthers Whilst Mistaken for Others. Which I think is a far better title. And, you know, damn Melanie and Catherine and my gang of my rabble. I want it to be something that's so droll like that, because I guess the influences were, you know, whether it's Jeffrey Bernard or even a little bit of Christopher Isherwood. When reading Bob Ellis's last memoirs, that was the first time that a writer's voice made sense to me. It should have before, because someone like Barry or Barry Hannon in particular. That voice is loud and clear, but for some reason, reading Bob Ellis, a lot of things made sense, and I progressed at a great rate after reading his last memoirs. And I do go off on tangents, don't I?
Well, that's I mean,
was Jodi Picoult like this?
Yeah, oh, absolutely, exact same, very similar. The both of you are very similar. We always just find it difficult
to tell
you.
Yeah,
the whole deal, because. I understand why they've gone with Detours. I mean, publishers like booksellers have to sort of keep one eye on the readers and try to pull it together. And you haven't taken the David Copperfield road from I was born here and I went all the way through here and this is the last thing I did. Narrative clean straight through. It's you pick up wherever you like, you run with it. There are even little snippets of memoir, which are maybe a paragraph long in certain chapters throughout the book. So it's a collage in a sense.
Collage is a good word. I think fragments is something we use a lot, but it's quite harsh.
isn't it? You're a fragment of a writer, Roger. the thought about doing a clean narrative through just was when I was first approached 6 or 7 years ago. My only request was if I'm going to pursue this, there's no way I'm going to do that because a lot of it, I'm not the best person to tell the story. If it was to do with music, what I've done with music, there are other guys even within my own band who are better writers than me, better prose writers, and it just held no interest for me. And to get to the names and to the stories, there's no great story there, and so I didn't think that would be of interest to anyone, barely of interest to anyone. And I've done a number of interviews over my time to do with music, and a lot of stuff's been covered. The other thing was I felt like I had nothing to prove. I've got a lot to prove personally, but as far as musicians, you know, a lot of particularly musicians when they're writing, want to write about how bad they are or how bad they're not. They're unmistakable genius, or that it's all a bit of a fallacy. I thought, well, still working out what I want to do with music, so I don't have anything to finish. I didn't feel I had anything to prove. And so I thought it was the right time to at least attempt something. The only person I wanted to prove something to was to Melanie, as my agent, my editor, and then meeting Catherine and HarperCollins, I wanted to prove something to them. So I felt okay to do that. But yeah, the David Copperfield approach was never an option.
We get, in this way, we get to sort of drop in on different moments of life, but also different relationships that you have with your father. Your relationship with your early self, there's a kind of a piece where you sort of talk about the anxiety of your teenage years and growing and going into adulthood, which is very honest, very raw, and I think for a lot of people very helpful. I mean, I don't think you set out there to do that, but I think if someone's reading that with the same kind of feeling in similar ways, they're going to feel that there is some sort of light or some sort of way to get hold of this.
It's the only reason I talk about it, and the only reason I have talked about it, because it can help, and I'm not a physician, medical, psychological. My mother is actually a therapist these days, interestingly enough, but she didn't pick that I was afflicted, so my cynicism about the dark arts continues. It was just that it can be helpful. And you can only write about what you're intrigued about. And it's intriguing to me why, at times, I know now how to try and avoid it, but why you get split in two. I haven't really quite figured it out why, when. Quite why I don't. And so I was hoping by writing about it I could understand it a little more. And maybe I have understood it a little more. Just not to write from a very opinionated way. I mean, I guess we're in the age of opinion, you know. And I didn't want anything in the book to be heavily opinionated. And I don't think there is much that's heavily opinionated. I'm an opinionated person. I try not to be expressing opinions all the time. I'm finding it really tiring.
Does that exclude sport? Like, are you allowed to have opinions about sport?
Well, I'm tiring of opinions on sport as well, because I'm amongst it, and I'm finding myself less and less enamoured with big sporting encounters. I mean, I know I get described as being a football tragic, and I don't think there's anything tragic about loving the aesthetics of a game more than the winning and the losing affects me, and in baseball and cricket and in women's football and in the world game. Sure, it affects me, but I'm finding myself just less and less attracted to shouting and opinions, and maybe it's just my hatred of sports betting that's leading me towards that. But no,
it's kind of a cancer, isn't it, on sport and what it means and the sports betting. It just seems to be going right through every sport.
I'm finding it so.
Mm.
Very disappointingly. And then, after reading Gerard Manane's beautiful book on his horse racing life and his love of the track, I'm this kind of person. As soon as I read a book, I read Robert Hughes' book, A Jerk at One End, on his fishing obsession, and I thought, that's it, I'm going to become a fisherman. And then I read Gerald Manane's book on Something for the Pain. Sorry, I'm misphrasing it. But his lifetime of being obsessed by horse racing, and I want to get into horse racing. But again, it wasn't from the betting. It was like, ooh, the silks. And the, you know, very easily swayed. It's probably a good thing that I don't read too much.
There is
Steve Bannon's book.
Yeah. Well, there's a recurring theme there. Whenever you do have, like you talk about sitting in a restaurant or sitting in a bar or sitting in a park, you do mention a book, like with a book, or like you often start with, you know, might be sitting there with a book or maybe scribbling some notes. Or how important have books become to you? I mean, you like to be by yourself. You like to spend time by yourself. Are you a person that has a book in the glove box? Is you a person that carries a book?
It's the only thing I carry apart from a hip flask at all times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you thought of bringing them together and putting the heat flask in a little cavity in the
pocket. Well, I'd probably miss out on the meat of the novel.
Yeah.
Well, that's my copy of the Bible, which I haven't read in a very, very long time. Really invaluable. Look, I found myself talking to a bunch of kids about it recently, and about where literature can take you, where poetry can take you, where non-fiction can take you. I'm finding reading off a computer, it's a necessary thing to do, I guess, just in the information age. But I wonder when I suddenly veer off into that into the rabbit hole of the internet, how dark I get, and I guess dark's only way to explain it, just how depressed is taking it too far. But when I do sit with a book in whatever form, hopefully, you know, having the papyrus in your hands, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 3 hours, and I just feel elevated. It's the only way I can explain it, even something very painful to read. And it's not just about release from yourself, it's like you feel somehow released, but also closer attached to what's going on in your own synapses and your imagination. I feel that your imagination's tangible, and when I'm apart from reading for a while, my imagination becomes a very scary thing, and it's just something to be feared. And so I think, quick, I've got to dull this, so I'll try and go and dull myself as quick as possible. But I've learned over, and only in the past 5 or 10 years, that if I can fall into a book, then I'm released from the terror of that, which is, you know, very, very fortunate. I'm very fortunate that's I do have the access to that.
Yeah, I always feel that my head is eating itself alive if it's not being fed with books. It just starts to turn on itself and starts to eat itself.
That very much. Yeah.
It's not very satisfying in any way.
No, the Hurricane always, well, if we've been on the tear for a while, and I think we were tramping through Europe a little while ago. I was touring over there, and she and I were there together, and she just turned to me and said, "Darling, we need something to feed our beautiful, beautiful brain." I think comparable to what you're saying, that we were turning inside ourselves and probably, you know, eating livers and hearts away, and we needed to be fed.
Mm. Especially on the road, and you spend so much time on the road. It's a, you have these vast swathes of time that you have to fill.
Yeah, a lot of it gets filled. You know, the touring life, I mean, I've been on the road for 30 years, and it's my life, and I'm very glad that it is. Travel makes me very uncomfortable and very anxious, but that's just part of the job, and it's the payoff is being on stage that night. But you do spend so much time looking out a window, being with people and being with strangers, and being a musician, people say the most ridiculous shit to you and outrageous shit, because music does funny things to people, and it really affects them. And so you get exposed to people being very raw with you very quickly and being very intimate with you. Another reason why I thought writing the book's okay, because I can, after a show, go out, go wandering by myself, be in a new town, go walking. As soon as people find out you're a musician, they just, bang, it's on. It's almost like you're a therapist or a member of the clergy. God forbid. People really do just say the most ridiculous shit to you and act oddly after shows, because I guess it can often involve intoxicants and emotions being pulled hither and thither. I thought, wow, I'm really being exposed to stuff here. So in the book, there was going to be a chapter called Name Dropping, and it was going to, you know, include this, my Anita Pallenberg story, you know, God rest her dear soul, or Keith Richards' story, or Pete Townsend's story, or you know, this person who I slept with, who I didn't, who I took drugs with. And but I thought, well, I need to do this in a unique way, so I'll just do it in haiku form. And it was really good fun, because, you know, but I thought, well, hang on, I went into this thinking, well, that's not what I'm going to do. And so I thought, well, it's much as it may be disappointing to some people that don't write about that aspect of what I've been through, but really, if someone buys me a drink, I'll tell them anything they want. You know, I don't need to put it in the book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll meet you in Los Gatos in Madrid, and you know, if you buy me a couple of cañas, I'll tell you all that. So there doesn't really seem to be much need to put it into a book.
Thank you very much for coming in, Tim. Both of us truly enjoyed this book, and I really want to get people who are listening to understand that it really is one of those books that dives in quite deeply and sometimes raw episodes on your life. They're not short stories, but they're sort of as we said earlier, they're a collage and brought together this whole experience. We didn't even get to talk about Melbourne. I wanted to bring in Melbourne into this. Because you seem to...
Barry Humphries writes about it so much better.
Okay, well, let's leave it to... Get hold of Barry's book, right?
I went to Melbourne for a reason that is possibly not there anymore, but I can still see it. It's... I get asked all the time, is rock and roll dead? Perko and I were talking about this the other day. It just comes up in every interview. Is rock and roll dead? And I said, well, no, because... I'm part of it, and I guess that sort of faux boho part that I see in Melbourne, I still see around the corners here and there. It's, you've got to go diving, you know, looking a little further, but if you get off your fucking telephone, it's there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is what, we get the same, are books dead? We say we work in the book industry, aren't books dead? And like, what? Are you nuts?
I'd see, you know, just in the States 3 months ago, and there was a couple of years there on the subway, and it was just phones and e-readers and whatever, and I'm just seeing the papyrus everywhere. You know, there's just books everywhere. Just that's shibboleth idea again, you know, oh, books are dead, rock and roll's dead. Stick around me a while, you know. Stick around you guys a while. Stick around John and Ben a while. It's just not how these things get into just laziness, I guess, let's just keep fighting the good fight.
Yeah.
It's no longer a fight. Just keep spreading.
We're winning. Keep winning.
Spreading.
Yeah.
Well, keep winning. Keep winning. It's dangerous language.
Yeah, we can't go there. Tim, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And you can get hold of Tim's book, Detours, at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.